Thank you very much indeed, and it's a great privilege to be here. The topic of inequality has a moral and a technical dimension, a call on both conscience and reason. And while I'm aware of the former, I shall focus my remarks this morning mainly on the latter. One difficulty is that economic theories linking inequality and development are often advanced from a priori foundations on fairly weak evidence. The view, for instance, that rising inequality is the inevitable consequence of new technologies, or for that matter, of the growth of world trade, and these views have been in competition with each other in the economic literature for several decades, although they are not lacking in plausible connection to some facts, they are derived from first principles and as primary or universal explanations, they invite skepticism, not least because they suggest a bit too conveniently that nothing really should be done. Technology and trade represent progress, after all. And so the silent message is, don't get in the way. The rise in inequality is simply an incident to otherwise important advances. There is a long tradition of this in economics, going back at least to the English debates over the poor laws in the early 19th century, when David Ricardo, a venture capitalist, by the way, and other true friends of the poor, insisted that the latter would only learn self-reliance if they were not fed. Come to think of it, we are watching a replay, in some respects, of this debate and this argument in the United States in our present presidential campaign. As you may perhaps be aware, and I am reassured by Professor Flosbeck that it's all right to be provocative, so I can tell you that in an interesting twist to this debate, one of the leading candidates, Governor Romney, released a video yesterday that was entitled, Mitt Romney Does Not Despise the Poor. True. I hope you find this reassuring. The authors of the World Bank's East Asian Miracle Report almost 20 years ago offered a counter-narrative to the trade or skill-biased technological change apologetics for rising inequality, according to which argument, greater equality would promote educational effort, the development of human capital, and therefore economic growth. This is morally appealing, surely, in certain ways, but I find it a bit too close to the same habit of reasoning from first principles on weak evidence, especially when you consider how much effort the poorest countries put into schooling without actually becoming rich. In any way, it is not necessary to prove a linkage to growth in order to value both equality and education. My own approach to these issues, in conjunction with the research team that the chairman was gracious enough to describe, may be described as evidence-based economics. It is to work on data and measurement first, and then to see what inferences may reasonably be drawn. I have terrific respect for the work that others have done in the same area, the World Bank, the World Institute for Development Economics Research, the Luxembourg Income Studies, and elsewhere, the work of people who concentrate on data issues in this field. The work that I've done complements that work and has the advantages of wide coverage. And if I could have an advance of the slide here, just to describe a little bit about the work product of the University of Texas Inequality Project, And to show in the next slide the range of data points that we're able to put together out of a single, into a single consistent, conceptually consistent series of measures of economic inequality, whose focus is mainly on pay for labor, and that is to say on the reward to work. The technical details are not for this forum, but they are fully exposed in the books and on the web, and I invite specialists to review them, as they provide an opportunity for many countries who are interested in monitoring changes in inequality in an inexpensive and up-to-date way to do so. And then this is a useful supplement to the business of expensive business of conducting regular surveys. And anyway, I'm anxious to see the technique used as widely as possible. The search for patterns in the data is risky because they may not, in fact, be any. The data may be too noisy, or relationships may simply not exist. Therefore, when patterns are found, they are generally significant. And in fact, our method yields measures that are quite clean. They cover over 150 countries over about 40 years. So it is a truly global approach, not limited to the rich countries. And some very clear and basic patterns do emerge. What I'd like to do is to call your attention to three of them. The first of the slides, a very simple exposition of the measures themselves, showing their average values in relation to each other and the degree of fluctuation over time. And what we find is that development generally does reduce inequality. Wealthier countries have an industrial working and middle class, a welfare state, progressive taxation, strong trade unions, minimum wages, and economic growth tends to strengthen these institutions so that growth is generally of an equalizing character. It's the basic finding here. However, there are exceptions at both ends of the income scale. It is true, for example, in the case of China, that rapid growth has been highly unequalizing. Everybody knows this because of the rising urban-rural differential, something Kuznets pointed out many, many years ago. And in the case of the US, there's also an exception because of the dominant position of the financial sector. Rapid growth has tended to be driven by bubbles, which greatly enrich those who were already at the top of the income distribution. But Kuznets, with that modification, still has a lot of insight stretching out over more than half a century since he first articulated his curve, his curve in 1955, and that's roughly the pattern, I mean, broad outlines that we find of the relationship between inequality and income. Secondly, if one looks at the movement of inequality over recent years, there is a very strong common global trend, a common global movement of inequality with a powerful upsurge beginning around 1980 and culminating in 2000. I'm going to show this one more. This is the pattern in the graph in the background. In our measures of inequality measured within countries, over a very broad spectrum of countries around the world. And the other insets show measures of inequality taken between countries and a measure of the profit share in the OECD countries. And you can see that they also reflect essentially the same pattern. The turning points and the extraordinary upswing in global inequality in the 20-year period from 1980 to 2000 strongly suggest that the timing is associated with major changes in the global financial regime. That is to say, in the financial governance of the world economy. That is to say, with the onset of the debt crisis in the early 1980s and the cascading of that crisis around the world, of course, the end of the communist governments in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and finally the liberalizations and so forth in Asia in the 1990s. This is also the period of the rise and implementation of neoliberal development doctrines. So the correlation between these two phenomena is remarkably strong and remarkably clear, common around the world. It suggests that the control of inequality is a problem above all of global financial governance, of limiting the power and reach of unstable financial forces. A few countries whose institutions permitted them to resist those forces were able to escape the rise of inequality, at least for a time, but they were very few, and not all succeeded in doing so indefinitely. And on the other hand, when financial pressures receded in the 2000s, interest rates fell, commodities prices rose, countries detached themselves from the International Monetary Fund, and numerous countries were able to reduce inequalities. This has been mentioned already that in South America in particular, we have evidence of declining inequality. It's actually not limited to South America, though that is the place where the evidence is most strong. Third, and I will cease with the slides at this point, I want to talk about the relationship, because it's very important for economic policy purposes, between equality, inequality, and employment and unemployment. We don't have consistent measures of unemployment for a great part of the world, but where we do have those measures, the evidence is quite strong that less inequality in pay structures is associated with a better outcome for jobs. Inside Europe, for example, the more egalitarian countries, typically to the north, have enjoyed systematically lower unemployment over many decades than the more unequal countries toward the south. This is, I think, in flat contradiction to the very common and standard story that touts labor market flexibility, that is to say, increasing inequality, as a solution for unemployment. The facts appear to go in exactly the opposite direction. And one can ask, why is this so? And the answer is, I think, that there are very plausible, sensible, theoretical reasons why we should expect this to be the case. I'll just give two of them. The first is that inequality fosters migration. It fosters the search for better jobs. Why? Because the good jobs are few in number and the differentials are large, and so people leave the bad jobs, and whether these are farm jobs or low-paid service jobs, to try and find better ones. And since only a few of them will succeed, the remainder will end up as unemployed for a substantial period. There'll be more applicants than openings. This, you can see this process at work once you look for it practically everywhere. You can certainly see it in the United States in the migrations from the south to the north in the 1950s. You can see it in modern China as the barriers to internal migration and continental national economic integration were reduced and people moved from the countryside to the cities, and the migrant population is substantially the equivalent of an unemployed population in the industrial West. But it's certainly to be expected, and it is in fact to be found across Europe as well. Over time, secondly, countries that successfully compress their wage structures, that is to say, not that compress wages, but that reduce the inequalities of pay, find that those structures, strong minimums, tend to function as a kind of standard, rewarding efficient businesses and penalizing those that need a low-wage labor force. And this, I think, also was a point that was made at a session yesterday, that the use of low wages is a way of allowing obsolescent businesses to continue to survive and to resist adaptation. And so a deliberate policy of compressing wage structures within reason has the effect of raising average productivity, real income, living standards, and the stage of development. It is a gradual but useful supplement to development strategy implemented by supporting collective bargaining and by having an enforceable floor on wages, an effective minimum wage. Final point, did inequality cause the Great Crisis? There is a developing story to that effect about, in the U.S., competitive consumption standards in the middle class leading to unsustainable household debts. It's a story, again, with a certain surface plausibility, but I would resist going too far down that line of analysis and narrative. I believe the story misses the essential elements of agency in the financial sector, the elements of predatory and fraudulent lending practices fostered, quite deliberately actually, by desupervision of mortgages, the act of removing the police from the beat, the desupervision of mortgage origination, of securitization, and of the insurance function that was supposed to be provided by credit default swaps. The inequality that you find in the tax data in the United States, which does go up as the housing boom proceeds, relates mainly to the incomes that flowed to bankers, to financial sector actors, from practices of these type. In this respect, and as a parting metaphor, I think there is a good parallel to be drawn, and it wants to ask, what is the greater meaning of an inequality statistic? I think there is a good parallel to be drawn between inequality, economic health, crisis on one hand, and blood pressure, physical health, and let's say heart attacks or strokes on the other. In both cases, there's a healthy range. And within that range, lower values are generally better, indicative of a healthier and more robust organism. The values can be too low, and zero inequality, like zero blood pressure, isn't found anywhere except in the cemetery. But when the numbers go up, even though you may not feel it, it is a sign of trouble to come. And of course, as we move toward the great crisis that broke in 2007, 2008, 2009, the numbers did go up. They went up sharply, dramatically, particularly in the United States and other advanced countries. And the world ultimately experienced a massive economic heart attack. This was 4 years ago this week. We should not, having gone through that experience, think it reasonable to expect a full economic recovery. Precisely because what the heart attack revealed, what the crisis revealed, was the vast decay in the core organs or institutions on which we had been relying to provide the impetus for economic growth. We are therefore impaired, and what we face is not an earlier automatic return to some previously established growth path, but a very substantial job of reconstruction of institutions and mechanisms to permit us to live in a sustainable way, given what we have gone through. Treating the symptoms, in this case, treating inequality by keeping it under control, by implementing basic direct measures, including, for example, minimum wage laws and support for collective bargaining so that working people can have an effective voice in setting their own pay standards, is, I think, not a bad place to begin. Because while it may not be a cure for the larger problems that will prevent a return to growth, it enables us to live, perhaps to maintain our societies while we work out what the appropriate strategies actually are. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Professor.